went out and spoke with Grant Hayes and disposed Laura Ackerson's remains.
Yes, ma'am, that's correct.
And it was almost a full moon that night, wasn't it?
I believe so. There were lots of trees everywhere.
Okay. But you went and got into the boat, and you testified here before the jury that you paddled out into the middle of that creek. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes, ma'am.
And then did you continue to paddle, or did you yourself start taking pieces of Laura Ackerson and throwing them into the water?
Ma'am, I never saw anything.
Okay. How big was that boat, ma'am?
I believe everyone witnessed it. I don't know for sure what the measurements of it are.
You were in the boat.
That's correct. I was at the back of the boat.
Who else was in the boat?
Grant Hayes.
Okay. And were there any coolers in the boat?
No, ma'am, not at all.
What could you see in the boat?
Whenever I got in the boat, I just saw black plastic.
Okay. And then you, there were two oars in that boat. Did you use both of the oars or
just one?
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
And so you were paddling. How long did it take you to paddle over to the middle of the creek?
I don't recollect.
You said when you first got out that you and Grant wanted to go one way, but the boat started going the other way. Is that right?
I said whenever we pushed the boat was facing going toward the right, but we wanted to go toward the left. So instead of trying to turn around, we just rowed the boat backwards. Boat kept rocking, and I kept telling Grant to be still. He was going to flip the boat over.
This was about what time at night?
I don't recall exactly. It was dark.
And when you got out to the left, because you couldn't turn the boat around.
Yes, ma'am.
What did you do?
I just paddled, and the boat was filling up with water, and so I started bailing the water out of the boat. While we were trying, I was paddling with one oar and bailing the water out at the same time.
What were you doing out in the boat that night? What was your plan?
I didn't have a plan. I was just doing whatever he told me to do.
And when you started bailing out the water from the boat, what was Grant Hayes doing?
I honestly don't know. He was behind me, and I didn't see him. I was just trying to keep the boat in the center, not going into the grassy areas. I heard animals all around me, and that was my primary focus, was to keep the boat from sinking, being flipped over, and keeping it away from the grassy areas.
When you testified, when you talked on direct, when you testified before this jury earlier today, you said it took a really, really long time.
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead.
It seemed like it took forever. Yes, ma'am, it sure did.
And it took forever for you to paddle and keep the boat from going into the grass area?
Yes, ma'am. Just the whole experience of being on the boat, that's correct.
But Hayes, isn't it true that when you were out on the boat, that you were taking Laura Ackerson's remains and...
Ma'am, I never saw anything.
Wait to the end of my question, please. Isn't it true that you were taking Laura Ackerson's remains, which included her torso and her head and parts of her leg, and throwing them over the side of the boat?
Again, I never saw anything that was going on behind me.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. I'm going to apologize in advance for my voice. It may or may not hold up today.
Doesn't sound too bad.
So far. It's one of those occupational hazards of a pediatrician. You catch things.
Yeah. But usually you don't. You've got a good immune system, so must have been bombarded this time.
It's been a tough winter.
Yeah. Okay, well, we have a tough episode, so that matches up well.
Right. It does.
Yep. So this episode, A Bitter End, it's about the murder of a young woman, Laura Ackerson. Now, when 27-year-old mother of two, Laura Ackerson, went missing back in July 2011, her friends were concerned that she had met with foul play right away. Laura had been locked in a bitter custody battle with the father of her two young sons, Grant Hayes. Now, Hayes had wanted Laura to give custody of their boys to him and his wife, Amanda, and he'd written a song describing Laura's death as well. Grant Hayes and Amanda Hayes were charged with Laura's murder that October when Laura's dismembered remains were found in a Texas creek. The bitter dispute over custody of the children had moved to a disturbing, horrific murder of Laura, a young woman who was just beginning to create a happy life for herself and her children. The trials of Laura's murderers would bring to light a darkness that no one could have foreseen.
Now, this is pretty cold and callous.
It's very, one of the most cold and callous I've read about so far.
I mean, it's not enough to just murder the person, but then they dismember her and drive her over 1,000 miles to dispose of her remains. That's just horrible.
It is horrible. It's a horrible story. So before we open the beer and get started talking about it, I'd like to just thank some of our 5-star reviewers. So I'd like to give a thank you to Craft Beer Fanatic, Kind of a Chef, Airy D, Favka, J. Joe Texas, and Mad as Birch. So welcome to the brewery, guys. Thank you so much.
Welcome, guys. Come on down to the quiet end.
Have a beer.
Absolutely.
What are we having for a beer today?
Today we're having a beer called the Event Horizon. Pretty cool name.
I like that name, yeah.
It's by Old Hickory Brewery, which is in Hickory, North Carolina. And for those of you who don't know where that is, like me, I found out that Hickory is kind of like halfway between Winston-Salem and Asheville. So
okay.
There's your geography lesson for the day.
Thank you.
So Event Horizon is an American double stout. These are stouts that are usually barrel-aged, either in bourbon or whiskey barrels, and they're very often infused with coffee or chocolate. They tend to be a bit higher in alcohol and generally pretty full-bodied. And I know I've done a lot of stouts before because that's one of my favorite types of beer, styles of beer. But here's another one. So the Event Horizon poured a pitch black color. No light gets through it. I think that's why they call it Event Horizon.
Oh, okay. Because as the event happens, then you start to see the horizon?
No, because it has to do with black holes and stuff, and there's no light.
Oh, okay. I got it.
So it has a tiny but quickly disappearing tan head. Nice aroma, roasted malt, some bourbon, a little bit of vanilla and chocolate. Even better taste, coffee, a smoky vanilla taste, some molasses, little chocolate, and the aforementioned bourbon. This is a thick, rich stout meant to be sipped.
It sounds really pretty delicious.
It is.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Let's open it up.
Okay. Okay, Jill, got the beer, got the glasses. Let's head on down to the quiet end.
Sounds like a good idea.
There's a fair number of people here today on this afternoon.
Yeah, well, it's nice weather.
Yeah, it's almost spring-like.
So I think that brings some people out.
Sure. You've been hibernating all winter.
That's right.
So good to see everybody.
We might have to warn them what we're going to be talking about, because this is a tough case.
Yeah, it's kind of graphic.
It is.
Maybe we should.
Yeah. Fortunately, no kids here at the bar.
Well, I would hope not.
Yeah. So, Laura Ackerson, she was born in April of 1984 in Hastings, Michigan, to a Brenda and Roger Ackerson. There were 6 other children in the family, and when Brenda and Roger split up, Laura was just a toddler. But it was a messy, nasty divorce which left the children emotionally scarred with conflicting loyalties between the two parents. So in 1996, Laura moved to Iowa with her mother, and she graduated from Sully's High School, and that was Linville Sully High, and that was in 2003. So Sully was a tiny town with a population of only about 800 people.
I guess tiny.
Yeah, that's even smaller than that Irish village where Rachel O'Reilly lived, I think.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. But Laura graduated a year late because her childhood had had a lot of disruptions and things going on. So, but she did graduate just a year late.
Yeah, and the childhood was otherwise okay despite the divorce?
Well, we don't know a lot about it, yeah. But we know that it was a nasty divorce.
Right.
So there was a lot of, you know, mixed up loyalties and things, so there weren't great relationships with the siblings and everybody.
Right.
A lot of it was broken up.
But nothing about her that sprang out or leaped out?
No. Okay. No. Now, her half-brother, Jason, he lived in North Carolina, and he was one that she did keep in contact with. And after he got an apartment in Youngsville, about half an hour outside of Raleigh, Laura moved out south to be with him and to get a new start in her life. Now, Youngsville had a population of less than 1,200 people in it, so it didn't offer much more than Sully had in job opportunities or in social activities, things to do. So after about 6 months in North Carolina, Laura moved from Youngsville to Raleigh.
Wow, from a teeny town to a big city.
Lots to do in Raleigh.
There sure is.
And she got a waitressing job there at an Applebee's restaurant. So she had a bright, outgoing personality and youthful good looks, and she was a really successful waitress. She also met and became friends there with Heidi Schumacher, another young woman, and they both moved on to work at the Front Row Sports Bar nearby. But then Heidi left to pursue a career in insurance, and Laura began taking online classes, and she got an associate's degree in arts in 2005. She had a real interest in graphic design, which she built on independently by doing study online and just figuring some things out on her own. She got pretty good at it from what I read.
Yeah, and it sounds like she's got some plans here.
Yeah, she wants to make something of her life.
Exactly.
Smart girl, too. Smart young woman.
So, besides online classes and working on her art degree and waitressing, she worked for a furniture store, Bassett Furniture, doing retail sales and helping customers with decorating. So there's her art stuff coming into
play. Yeah, she had an eye for that kind of a thing.
So she and Heidi remained friends.
They did.
And she became close to her family, Heidi's family. Spent time with her parents in Wake Forest. And apparently Heidi's family filled the void in Laura's life from her fractured family relationships. Because with the exception of her brother Jason, Laura's family were all in the Midwest. It doesn't sound like she had much contact with them.
It doesn't seem like it. Even afterwards, it didn't seem like there was a lot of involvement with her family.
Right. So in April 2007, Laura called her brother Jason to tell him about someone she had met. She was very excited about this guy named Grant Hayes, a wonderful man she'd started dating. Jason was happy and hopeful and a little bit nervous because she'd had some disastrous romances in high school, and he hoped her judgment in relationships had improved. Whoa.
Yeah, it's not unusual for a young woman to have that kind of issue until they get more mature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Jason felt that she was pretty vulnerable, tending to be too trusting and eager to love. So you got to be a little hard-nosed about that stuff sometimes, right?
Yeah, which I think she was just starting to learn when her life was tragically taken. She was just starting to gain that maturity and self-confidence.
Yeah.
So at the end of April, Laura's friend Heidi had returned from an 8-week course for her insurance training in Chicago. And when she came back, she met with Laura for dinner. And they were celebrating Laura's 23rd birthday at an Italian restaurant. But she said that Laura could hardly sit still. She was so excited. And she blurted out, "I got married," telling her friend that she'd gotten married while she was gone.
Well, that sounds a little bit impulsive, huh?
Yeah, it
does.
This
is a guy she's just fairly recently met.
Yeah, within a couple of months.
So they went from meeting to courtship to marriage.
Yes.
Boom.
She said that she and Grant had exchanged vows in front of a justice of the peace in Raleigh that same day. So that was April 30th, her 23rd birthday. Now, Heidi was really surprised, a bit concerned and taken aback, but this is her friend, and she wanted to be positive about it, so she smiled and congratulated her. But she hadn't even known that Laura was seeing Grant. Laura told Heidi that Grant was a musician who would be playing at the very restaurant they were at that night. And Laura introduced Heidi to Grant in the parking lot. Now, Grant, he was shorter than Laura. He was an African-American man with a shaved head, and he played guitar. And she thought he looked familiar. So it finally came to her that he was the same musician who'd been playing at the Blue Martini Bar and Lounge, where she and Laura had gone out together just before Heidi had left for her insurance training.
Okay.
So she had seen him before.
She had. But the insurance training was 8 weeks. So in those 8 weeks...
A lot had happened. Yes. Now, Heidi knew that Laura had talked to Grant that night during his break between sets, but she had no idea that there'd been further contact between the two. And Heidi had some misgivings. For one thing, Grant seemed kind of egotistical and patronizing to her. But she hoped that she was wrong because she wanted her friend Laura to be happy. Now, Grant, he was 5 years older than Laura, but they shared the same birth date, April 30th. And Grant was Grant Hayes III, the son of Patsy and Grant Hayes Jr. And he had one sister named Grantina. But thankfully, she went by Tina.
No kidding.
So that's not a very good name, in my opinion. But in high school, Grant was popular. He played the guitar in local nightclubs, which really boosted his attractiveness to the girls. And he could be very charming. Now, when he was 18, he married a ballerina named Emily Lubbers, and he moved to Greenville, North Carolina, with her. Now, he said Emily's dancing inspired his songwriting. Emily was a student at East Carolina University, but she also worked. And one of the problems was that Grant couldn't find work that suited his tastes, and this caused some problems in their marriage, like, really early on, because she's going to school and working, and he's just kind of not earning any money playing his guitar at that point, and most jobs that she suggests or that he could have qualified and gotten, he thinks he's too good for it.
Exactly. Grant thought he was too good for any job that he was qualified to get.
Seems to be, yeah.
So I don't think it mattered what the job was. It was beneath him.
Mm-hmm.
So guess what? The marriage ended.
Yeah, not surprising. I see that.
And
yeah.
this woman was 18 when she married him. Or was he 18? Were they both 18?
I think they were similar age. He was 18, but I think they were about the same age.
So the marriage didn't last too long. And after it ended, he became depressed and got psychiatric care. He was started on antidepressants and lithium. So they must have diagnosed him with manic depressive disorder.
I think so. Also known as bipolar. Right.
He moved back to Raleigh. Regularly went to church and studied the Bible. In 2003, Grant seemed to become obsessed with Tupac Shakur's music. He memorized the lyrics just as he had memorized verses from the Bible. So, I'm not sure, is Tupac a good role model?
Oh, well, that's very, I don't know. I mean, Tupac died. He was shot and killed.
Right. Grant's drinking increased. He started smoking marijuana regularly. And he progressed to using cocaine and heroin. Now, that doesn't sound like his life's going on.
That's never good.
No. However, he seemed to be functioning in life despite the pattern of drug abuse. He was making money performing and continued on his prescribed medications. Then he began using something called 2CE, which is a synthetic hallucinogen. And he seemed to be immediately addicted to it. Drug's effect lasted 6 to 8 hours, but it also changed his perceptions for days at a time. Grant apparently snorted this stuff regularly. He became nonsensical, impossible to speak with rationally, and delusions of grandeur.
Yes, so which he already tended that way anyway, to think he was pretty great.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's because his musical talent early on made him feel special, which some athletes get that kind of attitude as well.
Well, if you have a talent that you're rewarded for, you're going to start feeling like you're kind of special.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, you are.
So that's Grant. He feels like he's a musician. Anything else is beneath him.
Yeah, it seems that way. And then during this time in his life, he seemed to be showing some real mental illness, which this is about the age when a lot of these things pop up, right? He's 20-ish?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly the real heavy ones, personality disorders, schizophrenia, things like that, are showing up late teens, early 20s.
Right. So that, with the combination of these drugs, could be a real problem, I would imagine.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, he's using heroin, cocaine, marijuana, and this synthetic hallucinogen, 2CE. Yeah.
So kind of self-medicating in a very negative way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's apparently still taking his antidepressants and lithium.
For a while he was. Yeah. Now, he had these random trains of thought that led nowhere, and he had trouble following through with any plans. Musicians who spent a lot of time with him felt that he'd permanently damaged his brain with the drugs.
He probably had.
Now, Laura had caught Grant's eye at one of his performances, and he spent time with her between sets, and then they started dating. The fact that they shared the same birthday made their relationship seem like fate in Laura's view. So Laura kind of had the propensity to believe in fate and astrology, things like that.
Mm-hmm. It was in the stars.
Yeah. So that kind of seemed like a sign to her that they should be together.
I can think of probably better signs that would indicate they could be together.
Yes, but you're an older, more mature person who's lived life and you've learned from it, right?
That's true.
Yeah. So she turned 23 on the day that they'd exchanged vows, and Grant had turned 28 that same day. Now, Grant felt that he was destined to be a famous musician, and Laura believed in him also, and she did support his aspirations. She actually was a bit of a salesperson. She lined up bookings for him, and she promoted him in some local venues, and she also was encouraging to him about writing songs and making his own songs to record.
So at least on the surface, this could be good. He's a performer. That's what he enjoys.
Right.
And she's finding work for him.
That's right.
It's a good team.
Could have been. But Grant, he became very controlling. He's got issues, so it's not that simple.
It never is.
No. He took advantage of Laura's trusting nature and her low self-esteem. And to promote him as a musician, he asked Laura if she would talk to his fans about their sex life and actually brag to them about the size of his penis. And she found this quite shocking, like it kind of came out of nowhere for her when he said that.
Well, I think I'd find that a little shocking, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little insulting.
Yep.
Yep. But when Laura refused, she was actually really horrified at the idea. And he said, well, you've got nothing to lose. And then he started belittling her. He said everyone knew that she was trash because she was in a relationship with a black man. So that's kind of self-belittling as well.
It sure is.
So it's strange that he had this idea. Then one night when Grant was late for a gig, the band leader complained that he needed to be there on time, and because the band leader swore at him, Grant said he was justified to threaten the man, and he pulled a knife on the man.
Well,
of
course.
Was kicked out of the club.
I mean, what would you do?
Probably not that.
Oh.
Right?
Probably not.
Probably most of us wouldn't go to getting a knife and pulling it on someone.
Probably would not happen.
It's a bad sign. So Laura, understandably, began to feel afraid. Grant was claiming to have blackouts at times when he would really act bizarre and violent toward her. And during one of these episodes, Grant had shot Laura repeatedly with a BB gun. Now, the little plastic pellets that hit her, they really burned and hurt her skin, although they didn't really cause any permanent damage to her. But she begged him to stop. She shielded herself with a towel and ran into one of the bedrooms. But she wasn't sure if this violent behavior was drug-induced or if he was truly a sadistic person. Now, he began to express some strange beliefs to her around this time as well. He told her that creatures from other planets followed him wherever he went, and that he was a time traveler. He thought the aliens were running the United States, he said, and that the world was destined to end on December 31st, 2012. Now, that was that a the Mayans or someone predicted that? That was predicted by someone.
Yeah, some ancient civilization.
That 2012 would be the end, and I know there was a movie made about that with John Cusack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Grant... I'm sorry.
Okay.
So Grant wanted to gather enough cash to get onto one of these alien ships when the planet ended.
Sure, it's not cheap.
I'm sure it's not. They're only going to take a few, right?
Right.
He believed that rich, famous, and important people would be in underground bunkers or on the alien ships. These ideas were increasingly disturbing to Laura. Well, I can certainly see that.
Absolutely.
She wanted to think that Grant was joking, but that became more difficult as time went on. And it must have been really tough. You know, she obviously knows he's doing all these drugs.
Yeah.
So, but maybe he's nuts because of the drugs, or maybe he's just nuts.
She doesn't know.
Right. That's a scary situation.
And she's really kind of on her own. She doesn't have a lot of support around.
No, because she had been getting more and more dominated by Grant. He'd isolated her from most of her friends, and taking control of every aspect of her life. When she became pregnant with his child, she felt dependent on Grant and trapped in an unpredictable relationship.
I think that's accurate. I think she really was.
Yes.
Maybe not as trapped as she felt. There probably was a way out at that point, but I could see in her place she didn't see that.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
So Grant asked Laura to be in a polygamous relationship with him, and when she refused, he had an affair anyway. In the second trimester of her pregnancy, Laura found out about Grant's affair. Grant spoke to the other woman on the phone, smiling, while Laura sat nearby. In front of Laura, he asked the woman to marry him and run off with him. Now, Laura confronted him after he hung up. Grant said it was all her fault because she refused polygamy request.
Yes.
Well, of course it's all her fault.
And as far as I know, that was a planned pregnancy because she believed she was married and that they were going to have a family together. So I don't know how on board he was with it. It seemed like he was giving her a hard time.
Well, definitely.
Yeah.
He doesn't sound like he wants to be married.
Well, not in the conventional sense of the word, no. And now he really hated Laura's friend Heidi Schumacher. He insisted that Laura stop talking to her. And despite Grant's demands, Laura did secretly continue to meet with Heidi. Now one day, Heidi was on the phone with Laura, and she overheard Grant yelling and verbally abusing Laura. And Laura began to cry and said she had to hang up the phone. So Heidi was really worried. So she was worried enough that she got in her car and drove over to Laura's. And when she pulled in, Grant was backing out of the driveway. Laura opened the door to Heidi, and she had a bloody nose that appeared like it may have been broken. And one of her eyes was swollen almost all the way shut. So it obviously looked like he'd hurt her, punched her, at least.
Yes, it does sound that way.
Now, Heidi wanted to call the police, and she also wanted to take Laura to the hospital. But Laura refused. She was crying and begging Heidi not to tell anyone. At this point, she was 8 months pregnant, and Heidi was worried about her pregnancy. But Laura was really wanting to make it work with Grant, partially because of coming from a divorced family and all the trauma. She really wanted to have a family for her child, an intact family. So she swore that he had never hit her before, and it wouldn't happen again. It was going to be okay. And Heidi really didn't believe it, but she stayed with Laura for about an hour and a half, trying to convince her to go to the hospital, which didn't work. And then she finally did leave Laura alone at the house, after she'd stopped crying. Now, 2 days later, Heidi met with Laura, and she'd covered her facial injuries with some makeup, but the swelling and bruises were still quite noticeable. But Laura insisted to Heidi that day that Grant had apologized and she was fine. It would never happen again.
Yeah, but that's the pattern of the abuser anyway.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm so sorry, honey. I'll never do it again. And then it happens again.
Seems like it always happens again.
Yeah.
And it starts during pregnancy quite a bit. We've talked about that before, that women are often abused during pregnancy.
Right. Well, there's all that added stress.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, Laura gave birth to her first son in May of 2008, and she named him Grant Ruffin Hayes IV. So he got the family name from the Hayes family. And Heidi visited Laura's home after she came home from the hospital. Grant's parents were really thrilled about their new grandchild, and they accepted Laura more fully into their family at that point. But Grant tried to get Laura to skip the baby's vaccinations, and he told her that African-American boys are more likely to get autism from vaccines. So, do you want to say anything about that?
No.
Not even worth addressing?
It is not.
No.
We know vaccines are safe. We know vaccines are effective. We know that there's absolutely no link to autism with vaccines.
Okay.
So, enough of the discussion.
I just wanted to let you get that in.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Sure. So, she wasn't sure what to do, though. She didn't know anything about it. And she did end up putting off the vaccines in case Grant was right. But eventually she did go ahead and do that. But Grant forbid Laura's brother Jason from visiting Laura too, so that she was further isolated. Now she did continue to see Jason, but only in secret. And he wasn't allowed to call her, but she called him. Now in contrast, Grant was constantly having friends over. Whenever Laura went out to work, he had people over. The problem with that is many of them were drug addicts and criminals, and they would get high and pass the baby around indiscriminately, which was super as you can imagine, very upsetting for Laura, the mother.
Can only imagine.
Of that child.
I mean, and plus, here she is. She's the one who's going out to work.
Yes.
I mean, he's got his music gigs, but he's...
And I think off and on, he did make some decent money, but it was off and on.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a sad, sad life for her.
It sure is.
Yeah. Now, in February of 2009, Grant's family staged an intervention to help Laura. So even his family is understanding that this isn't good. They told Laura that Grant had this crazy world takeover plan. Grant planned to have 50 kids with different women of all races to build his own empire. Laura's father-in-law, Grant II, said that Grant planned to do this until he was about 70 years old, keep having babies with different women. And he also warned Laura that Grant III would pimp her out if he felt like he needed to. That's something he'd done before.
Well, that's a great thing to hear from your in-laws.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, they gave Laura the phone number for Grant's first wife, Emily, the ballerina, so that she could kind of commiserate. And they're really trying to get Laura to leave him at this point.
It sounds that way.
Yeah. So Laura called Emily, and Emily's advice to Laura was really plain and simple. It was to run away as fast as she could and never look back.
In hindsight, that's great advice.
Yes. Now, Laura did take the advice for a little while. She spent 2 weeks at Heidi's parents' house with her baby, and those were the parents up in Wake Forest.
Right.
Now, when she returned, Grant's sister Tina took her to the magistrate to file assault charges against Grant. So even Grant's sister is supporting her in this.
Mm-hmm.
She also contacted the Safe Alliance in Charlotte about resources for battered women. So she was making that move away from him.
Yeah.
But then, for some reason, she didn't follow through. I don't know if he got to her and gave her the whole apology story again, I would imagine.
He got to her, wouldn't you think?
I would think so. And also, it was important for her to give her son this intact family that seemed to hold her back from leaving him for quite a while.
Right.
So she decided to keep trying to make the relationship work, which, you know, I can see why, but at this point, it seems like it's pretty much a lost cause.
Oh, it does. But, you know, hindsight is so easy.
That's true. That's true. But by the spring of 2009, Grant's drug use had really increased, and his behavior was more unstable than ever. Now, one night, he ran into the baby's room in a rage, swinging a baseball bat, and Laura threw herself between Grant and the baby. Then Grant ran off down the street screaming, still swinging the bat. Laura and Heidi managed to stay in contact throughout all of this, which was really good for Laura that she had someone. Now, one day they were chatting outside of a Starbucks when Grant pulled up in his car, and he yelled at both of them that he was powerful enough and had enough friends to have them both killed, and that he would do that. So soon afterward, Heidi bought a gun and actually got a concealed carry permit. But Laura wasn't comfortable with having a gun, so Heidi bought her a knife, which Laura carried with her in a little, like one of those little buckled covers that you put.
Mm-hmm.
And she carried that with her until the day she died. Now, Laura suggested a trial separation to Grant, saying that she could stay with her brother for a while, but Grant was adamantly opposed. He threatened to have her and her brother killed if she was to leave him.
Yeah, he's just getting more and more difficult to live with. I mean, his music career is going down the toilet.
Yes.
And his behavior is more and more erratic.
He
ended up just playing gigs for tips only, and he spent all that on his bar tab, so he'd basically play for free. He had been playing with college bands, but he stopped being invited. Now, Grant claimed that the reason was related to the knowledge he had about a murder. Someone was trying to kill him to keep him quiet, he claimed.
That's right.
Kind of grandiose, too.
Well, yeah, he had a lot of stories like that, which don't seem too believable. Although, on the other hand, who knows? He could have been involved in other murders.
Well, he could have been. Grant had an acquaintance in the U.S. Virgin Islands named Joseph Jose Hardin. Joseph Jose?
Yep.
Is that for real?
I believe so.
Okay.
That's what it said in the article I got it from.
Hardin was a music promoter and agent in St. John, and he thought Grant was a talented musician, and he told him that he could get 5 to 6 gigs a week for him in St. John. And Grant decided that his folk reggae style of music would go over well in St. John. So that sounds like an opportunity.
It does.
Maybe he can straighten himself out.
Might be good for Laura, too, if he leaves.
Yeah. So he saw it as a way to prove himself and get back at those who had rejected him. And what he ended up doing, he left Laura and the baby behind, and he went to St. John on his own. Within weeks, he had a following, so his music career was kind of flourishing in St. John. And he also had a new girlfriend.
Oh, well, that's not good.
No.
Now, he was always striving for success, but he always came up short. Now, Hardin soon decided that Grant was just too lazy. He could be very charming, but he balked when it came down to really working hard to get where he wanted to go. Now, while Grant was away, Laura told Heidi that she wanted to leave him for good, and she moved in with Heidi's parents again. Now, Heidi knew that Grant was abusive, and she was eager to support Laura in these efforts. And Laura decided that she wanted to take her son and stay with her father in Michigan. But just before Laura left for Michigan, she became ill. And Heidi took Laura to Planned Parenthood, fearing that, oh no, she's pregnant, in Wake Forest. And Laura found out that indeed she was 12 weeks pregnant.
Okay, so this was before Grant went to St. John.
I think he had left for St. John. He was already in St. John.
He was the father of this new baby.
It had been conceived, yes.
Yes. Okay.
She hadn't been with anyone else.
I didn't word that correct.
No, I know what you mean. So Laura, being who she was, she changed her mind about leaving Grant, and she called and told Grant about her pregnancy and decided to move to St. John and try to be a family again. Now, before Laura moved, she told her brother Jason that she knew that Grant had a girlfriend in St. John. They'd talked about it, and he'd promised to end the relationship immediately before she arrived there. So Jason was skeptical,
well,
as you can imagine.
I think rightly so, but we'll see.
Yeah. Well, Laura's second son was born on St. Thomas, 2 months premature, in August of 2009, and they named him Gentle Rain Hayes. Now, Grant explained the name to a music publicist by saying, "In my maturity, I'm understanding what masculinity is, and it's gentle." So this is all about Grant's ego again.
Sure is.
And Laura's going along with it. Both boys now have been named what Grant wanted them to be named, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No question.
So this contradicted Grant's behavior, though, because he continued to be abusive to Laura. Now, she had two children under 2 years of age, and there were frequent arguments about money and child care, and Laura wanted more stability. She still believed in Grant's talent as a musician, but he wasn't providing a steady income. Now, also, Grant was seeing another woman. She didn't know if this was the same one he'd been seeing before she'd moved down to be with him, but she knew there was someone else. And worse than that, he was partying all the time, and he was really incapable of helping her and caring for the children at all. He was out all night, and he slept all day. So this isn't much of a life for her.
It isn't. And this baby, the second baby who was born premature, had some kidney trouble, which
yes.
was requiring surgery.
That's right.
So just one more bit of stress on the marriage.
That's right. Now mostly on her.
Right. Yeah, Grant's oblivious.
Seems like it.
So here's the girlfriend on St. John, turns out to be Amanda Hayes, who becomes Grant Hayes' wife and his accomplice in Laura's murder. Amanda was born Amanda Perry Tucker 7 years before Grant was born. So an older woman.
That's right.
Her mother, Aretha, had two other daughters and a son. Aretha reportedly worked at a whorehouse in Farmington, Texas, when Amanda was conceived. So Amanda's father is unknown. Amanda's older half-sister was much older than Amanda and played a big role in raising Amanda. Her name is Karen. And she had a son, Dalton, who was just 2 years younger than his aunt. Family legend said that Aretha had married 8 or 9 times.
Yeah, so there's a history in that family.
That's a good history. Amanda coped by developing an elaborate fantasy life. She was eager to leave her family home, so she married at age 16. Had a daughter, Shay, in that marriage, but the marriage ended when Shay was only a year old. Amanda remarried an attorney, Ron Adamson. While they were together, Amanda finished high school and took a few classes, but they divorced after only 8 months. So what is she, 20? 19, 20 now, something like that.
Young, yeah.
Married and divorced twice with a kid.
That's right. Now, Amanda and her 5-year-old daughter, Shay, moved in with Amanda's sister, Karen, the older one, in Lubbock, Texas. And Amanda met a local theater director, and she became really interested in acting in the theater. Then she met a wealthy entrepreneur, Nicky Smith. He was 14 years older than Amanda, and he was the owner of an electric irrigation company. He also owned farmland and some other small businesses, so he was well-to-do. Now, Nicky traveled the world teaching people how to grow cotton, and after dating Amanda for a year, they got married in 1998. So Amanda and Shay were living a very different life once she married Nicky.
I guess.
It was a life of affluence and opportunities. So now she had this freedom from economic worries, and Amanda had time to pursue painting and acting and other things that interested her.
Oh, she straightened things out.
It seems like she really hit kind of the jackpot there, and her life was going to take a good turn.
Doesn't it?
But things didn't continue in that trajectory.
No. This is a tragedy of itself.
Yes. Their happiness was very short-lived because not realizing that Ink's Lake had been partially drained to allow work on the dam, Nicky dove in on Memorial Day 2000, and he landed in just 6 inches of water, breaking his neck, and then he was paralyzed from the shoulders down. Very serious injury, life-altering if not life-ending.
Absolutely.
And he was transferred to Lubbock for surgery, but he ended up getting pneumonia, which, as you know, can be very deadly, especially when you're in that kind of condition.
In people who are quadriplegic, it can be very dangerous.
Yeah. So Nicky was dependent on a ventilator, and things were not going to get any better. And he decided he wanted to go home and die rather than live such a horrible quality of life. And he died in October 2000. Now, the settlement of his estate was done with equal shares given to each of his family members. Amanda was a single mother again, but at least she had this significant inheritance now to help her raise her child and not be struggling. So this is when she decided she was going to use the money to try for a professional career in acting. So for about a year, Amanda and her daughter Shay lived in New York City, and after studying acting in New York, she moved to L.A. for a chance at a career in TV acting. Now, she did get some small roles, non-speaking roles, in The O.C., The Sopranos, Dexter, and According to Jim, and a couple others. But soon Amanda realized she wasn't getting anywhere. She moved to Texas with her mother, and she got a degree in real estate, but she wasn't happy with that either, so that didn't last. And then she returned to New York, and she pursued a career in cosmetology at that point, which I guess for a while she was moderately successful in that one. In 2007, she vacationed in St. John, and she really loved St. John, so she decided she was going to relocate there. And when she was there, she worked as a bartender, and then she ended up becoming an art gallery director. So that wasn't too bad.
No, that sounds like a pretty good life.
Yeah. But then in August 2007, she decided to expand the Art Association membership to hobbyists. And later that year, she met Grant Hayes. And she took guitar lessons from him. Now, according to some people who knew them at the time, she just took those guitar lessons because she liked him and she wanted to spend time with him. But soon they were definitely an item, and many of his friends were really angry with him because he still had Laura there and the two kids living on St. John's. And many of them thought that Grant was just using Amanda, this older woman who had some money, to get what he wanted in life.
That's probably a correct assumption.
I think so. Could be. Now, in January 2010, Grant followed Amanda to New York, and he moved in with Amanda and Shay. He told Laura that Amanda was an investor, though. And then when he told her he was sleeping with her, he said he was only doing that to advance his career. So at this point, Laura's really confused, and she decided she needed to go to counseling, which was probably a really smart thing to do. But then she'd allowed Grant to take Grant the Fourth, the baby, the oldest baby, to New York with him for a week. But then it became 10 days, 2 weeks, and Grant didn't return the boy. So instead of returning little Grant to Laura, he took him on a trip to Las Vegas with Amanda. And Grant and Amanda actually got married in Las Vegas that April.
Now, how can that be? He's already married. He's not divorced.
Well, that's what we thought. But Laura was shocked because Grant sent a photo of his Las Vegas wedding to her. And with it, he sent her a message that said, Laura, we've never been married because I never signed the paperwork. So she actually dug through her stuff and found her marriage certificate, and it was true. He hadn't signed it. I don't know how that happened. But she'd never been married to Grant. So she moved out of the rental house, which belonged to his parents, and she moved to her own apartment. Now, this apartment was on the second floor, and it was very secure because there was a gate, and you needed to have a key to get in the front door and then a key to get into the apartment. And there were also cameras.
Okay. So she's left the Virgin Islands?
Yes.
She's back in North Carolina?
Yes.
And Grant's out in Vegas or New York or someplace?
Right, right.
Okay.
Now, because Laura got a job Monday through Friday, when Grant came back, he had the kids on weekdays and she had them on the weekends. Because Amanda had moved back to North Carolina with Grant so that he could, I don't know if he just wanted to be with the kids or if the plan all along was to get the kids away from Laura, is more like what I'm thinking.
Well, yeah.
He's thinking he's going to use Amanda's money and get a lawyer and get the kids away.
Yep.
Which they said a lot of that was related to the fact that they were boys. He wanted boys, at least one boy.
Well, yeah. They're going to pass his seed on.
Right. Now, Laura, on the advice of a friend, bought a tape recorder and began keeping a log of her time with the boys and communication with Amanda and Grant. The court had ordered psychological evaluations of Laura, Grant, and the children to determine what would be best for permanent custody. Now, Grant claimed that Laura was mentally ill and that she had a very negative effect on the children, and he wanted custody.
Right. He wanted full custody. He wanted full custody, and he felt that Laura should have supervised visitation only. Now, Laura, not surprisingly, had other ideas. She said she thought the children should have a relationship with both parents with an organized parenting plan. Grant claimed that he had reported Laura to the FBI for online prostitution. Jeez. Amanda began to act hostile when the boys were exchanged. Laura was sure that Grant had badmouthed her continuously. So not surprisingly, Grant went through Amanda's inheritance pretty quickly, paying lawyers, taking trips, making a failed attempt to start his own record company. But he blamed their financial problems on Laura. While they're doing the psychological evaluation, the psychologist reported that it was concerning that Amanda and Grant wanted the children all to themselves and wanted Laura to basically disappear. They seemed to have no understanding of Laura's importance in the boys' lives.
Absolutely none at all.
Nope.
They just didn't get that or didn't care.
They didn't care.
No. Now, the psychologist went on to say that Grant needed to see a psychiatrist who was knowledgeable about addiction and polysubstance abuse. Now, when Laura got the report, she was really ecstatic. She appreciated the points that were given about how she could improve as a parent. And she felt vindicated by the psychologist's opinions of Grant.
Yes, so it's apparent that he's continued his polypharmacy.
Yes, yes.
No.
Now, Grant was in Hawaii when the report came in, and Amanda bought a plane ticket for him to return to because she was due to give birth to a daughter. They were going to have a baby now.
He was going to return to North Carolina.
Yes.
He's in Hawaii.
Yes.
Right.
So she bought him a ticket to return from Hawaii.
From Hawaii. Got
it. Now, in May 2011, the custody attorneys had a conference with the judge, and the custody hearing date was set for August 15th, 2011. Laura's attorney was optimistic, believing that Laura would get joint custody or even full custody of her children. So Grant knew that he was going to lose at least some control over his children and Laura at this point.
Well, it would seem to me that I'd give her full custody.
Would you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This guy's a drug addict.
Yes.
So to me, that disqualifies him from being a custodial parent at all.
Okay.
But
so you'd just give him visitation?
I'd give him visitation.
Yeah.
I'd even turn the tables and make it supervised visitation for him.
It seems like it. I mean, not just the drug use, although that's probably enough, but there are other things as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Grant's hostility was apparent in his future interactions with Laura once this report was out.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Not what Grant wanted.
Not at all. Now, Laura told a friend, If anything happens to me, even if I get in a car accident, please know that Grant did it. So this is horrible.
It is.
Things are getting really scary.
We've heard these stories before.
Yes.
Where women are trying to leave an abusive partner, and they always warn a friend, right? If something happens to me, so-and-so did it.
Yeah, so they seem to know that this is a possibility.
Can you imagine living under that fear?
No, it's horrible. Now, Laura, she'd been starting a business with a woman she met when she'd been working at a health food store. So this woman, her name was Siobhan, and Laura and Siobhan sold advertising to various local businesses to put these graphic advertisements on menus at diners and restaurants. And it had been going pretty well. In June, Amanda gave birth to the little girl, Lillian, by C-section. And Laura took the boys for a week because he still had custody, right? Grant still had custody most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But Laura went ahead and took the boys for a week so that Amanda could, you know, have some time off. And she even brought them in to meet their new sister at the hospital. So Laura seems to have an understanding of that the children need to have both parents in their life, even though Grant seems like really a horrible parent.
He seems like a lost cause.
But I think she's learned some of this from her counseling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Amanda returned home with her baby to a really financially stressful situation. There was no income coming in, and they'd received an eviction notice. Now, they didn't even have the money to put a deposit on an apartment. Grant's parents owned several rental properties in the area, but those were all occupied. So they were really facing the possibility of being out in the street with a baby, or three children, as it would be.
Right. So the only option at that point was to move in with Grant's parents.
Yes.
So the two boys, the newborn, Amanda and Grant, living with his parents.
Yes, and he did not take this well, as you can imagine.
I can imagine.
He doesn't have the, I don't know, what would you call it? The sense, the security to deal with something like that?
Right.
Yeah.
He didn't.
No.
So on Wednesday, June 15th, Laura met her boys at Monkey Joe's, which I didn't know what that was. It's kind of like a Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah, I've never been to one, but yeah, that's what I heard.
So she met the boys for a midweek visit. When it was time for her to leave, she hugged them goodbye, and Grant the Fourth began to cry. Grant was impatient, pulled the boys away, quickly leaving as the two boys cried. He was angry, and he told Laura there would be no more midweek visits for her. That night, Laura emailed Grant, thanking him for letting her see the boys and asking that they have 5 minutes or so set aside next time for a less upsetting or less rushed goodbye. On June 20th, Laura wrote again asking for another midweek visit. Grant responded angrily and denied her requested visit.
Yeah, so he's angry.
He is.
Yeah, which isn't something new, but it seems like maybe it's worse than it had been.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the other things going on in his life as well, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on June 28th, Laura met with her attorney, and they discussed the upcoming August court date. So she was really looking forward to this hearing, and her attorney is saying it's going to go well for her. She's at least going to get some joint custody of the boys, if not full custody.
Yeah.
So on Friday, July 8th, Laura picked up the boys a few hours earlier than usual. And they had a nice weekend. They played at Laura's house. They went to this bouncy house place. And Laura wrote in her journal that the boys had gotten along well and that she had some good hopes for the future, for how things were going to go for her as a single mom with the two boys.
Right.
Now, she spent most of July 12th with her business partner, Siobhan Mathis, and they met at Laura's apartment to go over their plans for their business. And then they went out car shopping for Siobhan, because Siobhan didn't have a car, so she would sometimes borrow Laura's to make sales runs and things like that that they were doing. But they didn't decide on one that day. Now, Grant sent Laura a message at 9:25 p.m. that night. If you want to try the midweek thing again, you can see the boys tomorrow. So Laura accepted his offer, and she said that it would be best if they had a beginning and an end time set in advance.
Mm-hmm.
Make things...
So this was
less stressful.
Kind of out of the blue, because he'd already told her after their last time that there was not going to be any more midweek visits.
Well, and that's what makes me think he was setting her up for what happened to her. That this was something he did to trap her.
That's why I asked it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely seemed that way, didn't it?
Yes.
Now, on Wednesday, July 13th, Laura headed out to make some sales calls for her business. Security cameras at her apartment complex showed her leaving at 8:10 a.m. It was a really good day for her sales that day. She called Siobhan to tell her about her sales several times that day, and she was running a little bit behind schedule, so she sent a text message to Grant at 12:56, telling him she would be there after her last appointment that afternoon. Now, when she arrived at her 3 p.m. appointment, she really hit it off with the owner of the restaurant, and he signed a contract, so that took her another half an hour or so to close that sale. So it was at 4:08 that Grant sent Laura a text. Would you like to keep the boys for the week until the 24th? So instead of having the midweek visit and then picking up on Friday, he was saying that she could pick them up that Wednesday and just keep them until after the weekend.
That's nice of him.
Yeah, well, he's surprisingly being generous at this point, which is suspicious.
Sure is.
Now, at 4:12, she answered the text, "Okay, I'm leaving now. Where will you be in an hour or so?" Then at 4:19, 7 minutes later, she left a message with a friend saying she was going to visit with her boys. Now, she didn't say specifically she was going to the apartment where she normally didn't go. She usually met them somewhere.
Right. Now, they're still in their place. They haven't moved in with his parents yet.
Right, right. They're still in their apartment.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she arrived at Grant and Amanda's apartment that evening, and no one ever saw her again after that. So this is when
she just disappeared.
She was killed at this point.
Yes.
Now, just after 2 a.m. on Thursday, July 14th, so this is like 10 hours or so after Laura had texted him, he visited the hardware department at the local Walmart. Very disturbing here, what happens. He's over there shopping, looking at saws. He actually asks one of the sales girls about getting bigger blades for a jigsaw, and then he ends up buying a reciprocating saw, which is what people use to cut drywall and big things like that.
Right. Got a big blade.
Yes. So he actually bought the power saw. He bought blades, goggles, and plastic tarps. So it's very ominous, obviously.
It does sound that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. Now, Siobhan Mathis woke up on Thursday morning, and she wondered why Laura hadn't called her the night before like she said she would. And she called Laura's cell, and it went straight to voicemail, which was really unusual, she said. And she tried several other times but got no answers. Now, Amanda Hayes called her daughter Shay that day to come pick up Grant the Fourth and Gentle. So the boys are still at the apartment. Laura has not taken them, obviously.
Right.
And she calls her daughter, who I think was like 20-ish, a young woman, an adult, to come pick them up. Now, Amanda said they were packing to move and needed the boys out of their way. So Shay came and picked up the boys at 10 a.m., and then she took them out for the day. They went to Monkey Joe's again. But then about 3 p.m., the boys are getting really tired and cranky. But when Shay calls Amanda to say, "I'm going to bring the boys back," Amanda says, "No, we need about 3 more hours. We're looking for a moving truck." Now, when Shay brought them home around 5 p.m., Amanda said that they needed to borrow her vacuum. So Shay had to leave again and get her vacuum and then pick up fast food for their dinner. So Shay, they think, got back to their apartment around 6 p.m. on that Thursday. And then at 4:08 a.m. on Friday, July 15th, Grant sent an email to Laura that was exactly like the text that he'd sent her on Wednesday. Said the exact same thing. "Would you like to keep the boys through to the 24th? So he's trying to document something here.
Yes, he is.
Yeah. Now, just after noon that Friday, Siobhan sent Laura an email which said she'd been trying to call and she was really getting worried. And around that same time, Grant had returned to Walmart. And this time he paid cash for 3 red and 3 black duffel bags. So he's spending some time at Walmart here. Something weird is going on. Where's Laura
all this time?
We don't know.
So later on, around 2 p.m., Grant sent an email to Laura complaining about not being able to get in touch with her on her cell phone. Around 7:30 that night, Amanda called Shay and told her they weren't moving Saturday, but were going to Texas to see her sister Karen. Quick change of plans.
Yes, and Texas is not close.
No, we're talking from Raleigh, somewhere around there, or suburbs, to Texas.
Yes.
And this is, they still live in Lubbock or someplace?
I think they were going to Katy, Texas, is where Karen lived.
Okay, so that's a suburb of Houston, basically.
Yeah.
So that's not too bad.
With only, 3 children.
Only 1,000 miles.
Yeah.
With 3 kids under the age of 2 or so.
When you're pretty much homeless, you don't have money.
No money. You're postpartum.
Yeah.
You've had a cesarean section, so not quick recovery from that.
No. Well, apparently there was.
Right. So Saturday morning at almost 7 o'clock, Grant made more purchases at Walmart. He bought a 120-quart cooler, 3 bags of ice. He then returned to the Walmart and returned the 3 of the 6 duffel bags he'd bought on Friday. Then he bought a 74-quart cooler.
It's ridiculous,
isn't it? Well planned out. Then he went to U-Haul, rented a trailer. That night, pulling the trailer behind his SUV, he drove to Target. He bought 2 wheeled coolers, a 75-quart one and a 50-quart one. So let's see, he's got a 74-quart, a 120-quart, another 75-quart, and a 50-quart. What are they doing with all those?
Right, and where's Laura?
And still no Laura. That Saturday night at midnight, Grant, Amanda, and the 3 children headed for Texas, 1,200 miles away.
That's right. And where's Laura? And if they killed Laura at this point, where is Laura when he's out shopping for these things? If Amanda doesn't know about it, there's just a lot of questions in this whole scenario. This whole day when Shay took the boys, what were they doing?
Well, you know what they were doing.
I have a good idea.
Or we do now.
Yes.
I mean, she had been killed. I think he killed her the night before.
Oh, yeah, I think they killed her that evening when she came
by. So she's lying dead in the apartment with the kids running around.
Isn't that awful?
Yeah. And then Amanda gets the her daughter to take the kids so they can dispose of or, as it turns out, dismember the body.
Oh,
yeah.
It's just dreadful. It's really, I mean, if there wasn't proof that it happened, I'd say nobody could do that. It's just awful.
There's ample circumstantial evidence.
They absolutely did do it. I mean, about 8 a.m., they rented a room at a Motel 6 in Alabama, and Amanda paid in cash and registered as Amanda Smith. Now, Siobhan was worrying about Laura, and she sent her another email. And then she did go out finally and report Laura missing that Monday. So it had been since Wednesday. Yeah. So it had been like 5 days by then.
So five days of no contact.
That's right.
And this is, I mean, they were in contact multiple times a day.
Yes.
So something's wrong.
Absolutely. Now, Amanda Grant and the children arrived at Amanda's sister Karen's house in Texas early Monday, and after taking a nap, Grant asked Amanda's nephew, Dalton, some really strange questions, very suspicious, about how deep the creek was, if there were alligators in it, how long was the creek. And then at 4 a.m. Tuesday, Amanda's nephew, Shelton, found Amanda and Grant sitting on the back of their trailer, and they drank some beer, and they asked Shelton questions. They asked him, "Do you hunt alligators? Where are the alligators?" Then they asked about feral hogs and if feral hogs eat humans and if alligators would eat human remains. They also asked where they could find sharks. So this is very strange, but Shelton is thinking, you know, they're just city people. They're just asking these questions. But if you know what's going on, you can see they're trying to figure out how to get rid of Laura.
What's the best way to dispose of this body or these body parts, right?
Yeah.
That's what they're doing.
These people have no conscience. How can you sit there and talk about that and not be totally devastated? Well, later that morning, Amanda approached her sister in the kitchen, and she said to her sister, "I hurt Laura. I hurt her bad. Laura's dead." So Karen is quite upset.
Sounds like a confession.
It's pretty freaky.
Yeah.
So they went outside, and Amanda asked Karen if Grant could come over to where they were. So I guess Grant was standing over on the side of the house looking at them. Creepy. And Amanda asked, "Is there any property here that has a big hole in it?" And then Grant asked if their well had a big hole in it. And Karen, she said she was kind of in denial at this point and wasn't really putting two and two together right away about what was going on here.
Right.
Which she eventually did, of course. But she was definitely worried. And then she did offer them the number of an attorney nearby that they could see, saying that if something really bad had happened, it's best to tell the truth and deal with it. But they just kept asking her about big holes. Grant told Karen he needed some acid then, and asked if there was a Home Depot nearby where he could go. And Amanda drove him to the Home Depot, where Grant purchased muriatic acid and black neoprene gloves, telling the clerk there that he had an odor he needed to get rid of. And the clerk was pretty much telling him that wasn't going to do it.
No, that's not.
Right. Now, Laura's friend Heidi learned that Laura hadn't been seen since Wednesday and totally was in a panic immediately. Well, immediately, her mind went to that he did something to her.
She knows what Laura told her.
That's right. So she went right to the police, and she was able to download over a year's worth of emails that Laura had set up a secret email account where she was storing some of these emails she'd had with Grant over the time to keep track of things for the court. So Heidi was able to download all that onto a disk and bring it to the police, which is pretty helpful in painting a picture of, you know, what kind of relationship this was and what was going on.
Right.
Now, the police, they went ahead and went to Laura's apartment, but there was no sign of her there. And the plants looked like they hadn't been watered, things like that. And they found Laura's logs of calls and interactions with Grant. And there hadn't been any notations in the books since Wednesday morning.
Not since.
Which was something she did pretty much daily.
So that same evening, Amanda and Grant took Karen's boat out on the creek. Karen saw them take something from the U-Haul, but she was busy watching the kids.
Yeah, so they left the kids in the house with Karen.
Yeah.
And took the boat out saying they were going fishing.
Huh.
Which certainly Karen didn't believe that at this point. She knew something was up.
Well, again, hindsight's so easy, but after the confession that her sister made, I would have been watching those two like a hawk.
Yes, well, I think she just was trying to be in denial about it. She didn't want to know.
I guess so. So meanwhile, back in North Carolina, the police found Laura's Ford Focus near her old apartment complex. This was on July 20th. They got the second key to the car from Siobhan Matthews and searched it, photographing the exterior and interior. They fingerprinted it and swabbed for touch DNA. Back in Texas, Amanda and Grant left Texas on the 20th of July. Before they left, they cleaned the coolers and dumped the acid in the bushes. They left two coolers and a machete behind. On Thursday, July 21st, the police went to the restaurants where Laura had her sales meetings on Wednesday the 13th, and they reviewed Laura's diaries.
Yeah, now on July 22nd, the dumped acid boxes were found by an environmental worker out in Katy, Texas. And they actually had cameras in the woods, those wildlife cameras that are set off by movement.
Yeah, motion sensors. Yeah.
Yeah. So he actually had videotape of Amanda leaving the boxes of acid near the bushes. Not that they needed it. I mean, Grant bought the acid. I'm sure Home Depot had cameras as well.
Yeah.
Now, after Grant and Amanda arrived at his parents' house back in North Carolina, detectives picked them up and took them in for questioning. They also had search warrants for the car. Now, two detectives from Raleigh drove to Katy, Texas to investigate Karen's house, so they drove all the way across the country. And they had two local deputies recruited to come along to interview Karen with them. Now, Karen invited them in right away and caved immediately, saying she just wanted to say a prayer and then she'd tell them everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, Oyster Creek was searched that afternoon, and Karen's boat was taken in for evidence. In the creek, they recovered two portions of Laura's torso, a part of a leg, and her head. And these remains were transported for an autopsy. So I can't imagine the people that found this, how they can ever get that out of their mind.
That's indelibly printed.
Yes.
You can't.
And why did they put it right there by your sister's house?
Well, I guess they thought the alligators were going to eat it.
I guess so.
But... And they don't know whose remains those are, but they have a pretty good idea whose they are.
A very good idea, yes. because they've just heard from Karen that Amanda told her that Laura was dead.
Right.
And Laura's told people, you know, and there's just so many things pointing to it, so they can't say for sure, but they're definitely thinking that.
A myriad of things that point to Grant and Amanda.
Yes. So the discovery of body parts in the Texas Creek changed the Raleigh missing persons case into a probable homicide case at that point.
Right.
Not definitely, but they're pretty certain. Now, Amanda and Grant's apartment had this large bleach stain on the carpet near the door. The shower curtain was gone, and the bathroom was exceedingly clean. An agreement was left behind, signed by Laura, stating that she would give up her parental rights in exchange for $25,000. So this was clearly a setup.
Yes.
To make it look like Laura had taken money and run off and left the boys.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on July 26th, divers were continuing to search the creek, and Amanda and Grant were held in jail without bond. They were each appointed a public defender. The district attorney in the case decided to try Amanda and Grant separately. So they would have Grant's trial first and Amanda's after that. So Amanda's trial ended up being postponed until 2014. So opening arguments for Grant's trial began on August 29th, 2013. His defense was that Amanda actually killed Laura and that he was just someone who helped her with the cover-up in order to protect her.
Right, but that's going to be her defense too. So as soon as they decide to try these two individually, they're going to finger the other one.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Interesting. The first witness that the prosecution called in Grant's trial was Laura's friend and business partner, Siobhan Matthews. She described her interactions with Laura on the day she disappeared. Then her friend Heidi testified of Grant's abuse and threats over the years. At one point, she broke into tears over the loss of her friend. Amanda's daughter Shay also testified about the day Laura disappeared and how she watched the boys all day. Shay testified that she found the receipt for the reciprocating saw in a stack of papers after the couple had been arrested. State showed jurors photographs of Laura's remains when the forensic examiner testified.
Horrific. Just horrific.
Prosecutors also presented the jurors with the lyrics to Grant's song, Broomstick Rider.
Yeah, that was the song he wrote about.
Which was about killing about the baby her. Mama of his two kids. Amanda's sister Karen was called as a defense witness, and she testified about Amanda telling her she'd hurt Laura. The defense was that Amanda was the innocent bystander. No.
No, you were at Grant's trial. So I'm the defense was that Grant was just helping clean up. So she had testified that Amanda had confessed to her.
Right.
Right.
So that's putting it back on Amanda.
Yes.
She did it.
Yes.
Grant's innocent.
That's what they're saying.
Yep.
So, yeah, so the defense was saying that this was a confession by Amanda, right? And the defense also said it couldn't be first-degree murder because the murder wasn't planned. In closing remarks, they asked the jury to take the emotion out of their decision.
Now, sure.
Yeah.
But I don't know how they can say it wasn't planned. It's clear it was planned.
Yes, but that's what they said.
Yeah.
And the reason they're saying take the emotion out of the decision, because if you think about what he did to Laura's body, you can't think that that's not a murderer. A normal person isn't going to find an accidental death or see something happen and say that they're going to do something so horrible.
Right.
Right. So that's where I think they were coming from with that. They're trying to say, well, disregard the fact that he did this horrible thing.
Yeah. The fact that she's dismembered.
Yes.
Don't let that sway your decision.
Right. They kept trying to minimize that, which is impossible to do.
It certainly is.
Now, Grant was found guilty of murder, and he got life without parole. He showed no emotional reaction when the verdict came in, and the jury had only deliberated for about an hour and a half. So the evidence was overwhelming.
Yeah, it didn't take long.
No. Now, the trial of Amanda began with jury selection on January 21st, 2014, and much of her trial was a rehashing of Grant's trial. Amanda's defense was that Grant killed Laura, and Amanda had no idea that Laura was dead until they got to Texas. And then she was made aware. So those 3 or 4 days when he's shopping and getting things ready and they're having Shay leave the house with the kids, Amanda has no idea. This is what she's saying,
right.
Which is not believable.
And she has no idea that Grant was throwing body parts over the boat.
Well, I think at that point she says that she did. Well, she didn't see anything.
Right.
But she did know that that's what was happening at that point. But she said she had no idea when they're driving across country that they had.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I know. But prosecutors had an excellent case against Amanda, of course. The condition of the apartment made it apparent that Laura had been killed there. Right by the front door was this big bleach spot. They also had the testimony of Amanda's sister Karen about what Amanda had told her. Now, Amanda's defense attorney's story was that Grant Hayes was a sociopath, and Amanda and Laura were both his victims. He portrayed Amanda as a victim who was just following what Grant told her to do because she was afraid of him. In the custody battle, Amanda's attorney said Amanda was the peacemaker. Amanda testified in her own defense as well, which is what we heard at the beginning of this episode, was her cross-examination.
Yeah, she didn't come across very well.
No. How can you, though? In this, there's really no defense of what she did.
I don't see how you can.
No. She said that on the day Laura disappeared, Grant and Laura were writing the custody agreement for money, like the agreement where she would get $25,000 and let Grant keep custody, and that Laura wanted to hold the new baby, Lillian. And as Amanda walked away and said no, Laura had gone after her and kind of grabbed her or fell into her. And as Amanda was walking away with the baby, Grant grabbed Laura to pull her away. Now, Grant and Laura tripped and fell to the floor. And this is where they say that Laura had accidentally died. This is what she'd said.
Okay.
That Grant had...
So Grant was involved, but it was an accidental death.
Yes, okay. Right. So Amanda went into the bedroom and shut the door, and she said a few minutes later, this is all Amanda's version that I'm telling you.
Amanda's alternative truth.
Yes. A few minutes later, Grant told Amanda that he was going to have to call EMS for Laura. He said he would help Laura into the bathroom, and then that Amanda should take the kids out for dinner and stuff so they wouldn't see their mom hurt. So he said, Laura's hurt, I'm going to take her into the bathroom, and... Every story that Amanda tells is she's looking the other direction, right? Yep. Or she's missing everything. So Amanda said she left with the children, and when she returned, Grant had told her that Laura was just fine. So Amanda went to bed thinking everything's just fine, and then Grant had left the apartment around midnight. Amanda didn't know anything the next 3 days, she said, when Laura's body was cut up and put into coolers. So the state called Siobhan Mathis to the stand, as well as the police detectives and Amanda's sister, Karen. Amanda again denied having anything to do with killing Laura or getting rid of her body. She even claimed that she was looking away while they were on the boat, and Grant was throwing body parts into the creek. And Grant ended up not coming in as a witness at all in her trial. But on February 14, 2014, the final day of testimony in Amanda's trial occurred. And the state called Patsy Hayes, which is Grant Hayes' mother, to testify on newly discovered letters that Amanda Hayes had sent to Patsy to read to Grant. So in these letters, Amanda chatted about her life in jail, and she said, "Please tell my husband that I love him very much, and I think of him every day." So this all goes against what she's saying about being afraid of him, obviously.
It does.
Yeah.
And then she also had a letter with a section for Patsy to read to Grant. And this read, "Hello, my baby. I love you so much. I hope you're doing good. Please take good care of yourself. I miss everything about you and can't wait to give you a big hug and kiss."
Gross.
She also added that she wanted to set up a time when they could meditate simultaneously.
Yeah, that's gross.
So closing remarks were given on February 17th. Amanda's attorney reiterated that Grant was a controlling sociopath who treated Amanda similarly to the way he had treated Laura. He suggested that Grant may have committed other murders in his past. The DA proposed that Laura may have told Amanda and Grant that she had recorded them as they forced her to sign the custody agreement that day, and then they decided they had to kill her. He also brought up that Grant had set up midweek visits the previous week in order to set her up for this last visit.
Yes.
Where he'd kill her.
Which makes it very premeditated.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. Now, Amanda had been there the whole time as Grant went out and bought the saw, the coolers, the tarp. She was probably home with the body when he went out to Walmart. That's the only way I can see it.
I'm sure she was.
Now the jury had 3 men and 9 women, and they began their deliberations after this 13-day trial. They deliberated for a little over 2 days, though, on this one. They spent a little more time. They asked to see the reciprocating saw and to read Laura's diaries, but the verdict was guilty of second-degree murder. No one had believed Amanda's story. Amanda made a really kind of weepy apology in this sweet, sing-songy voice to everyone who had been touched by this case. And the judge sentenced her to a minimum term of 157 months and a maximum term of 198 months. And she was given credit for time served as well. The children remained with Grant's parents, the Hayes, to be raised, the three of them together. And Grant appealed, and his appeal was denied. Amanda did divorce Grant in October of 2014.
I thought they were madly in love.
Well, not anymore, I guess. I guess being in prison for the rest of your life puts a damper on things.
Yeah, but she got off, to me, relatively easy.
She got off very easily, I think.
Right. 150 months is...
10 years?
12, 13 years?
Yeah.
That's not much.
No, she definitely got off better. He got life in prison.
Without parole.
And I think they both had very strong roles in it.
The way it was presented, absolutely. I don't think there's any other conclusion.
No, no, I don't think so either.
They were both active participants.
Yeah. This was really a dreadful case, and I'd never heard of it before. I'm surprised it didn't get more publicity when it happened.
And it's not that long ago.
No, it's not. You what, maybe 10 years ago? It's 2017 now, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
2007.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Anyway, so they both got punished at least. And before we transition into the feedback segment, I'd just like to remind people to follow us on Instagram, Tygrabber Podcasts, on Twitter, at Tygrabber Pods, on Facebook. You can go to tygrabber.com/Facebook. Also, our website has gotten rejuvenated and it's available. And you can shop the brewery, buy t-shirts, glasses, coasters, bottle openers, all kinds of cool stuff. And you can join Team Tygrabber, because next month we have our members-only episode starting. So that's exciting. I'm really excited about that. And also, we still would love to get some 5-star reviews. If you like our podcast and you have the time to take a few minutes and give us a review, that really helps us to find some new listeners on iTunes, if you can just leave a little review of how you like the podcast.
That's right. We love the feedback.
We do. So let's just listen to a little bit of music and we'll do our feedback segment.
Okay.
Okay. Welcome to our feedback segment. What have we got, Dick?
Oh, we've got a few things to discuss here.
Okay.
Want me to start?
Sure, you start.
I'm going to get rid of the tough one first.
There's a tough one?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
All right.
This is from Lauren regarding the baby Gabriel case.
Oh, yeah. You deserve this one, though. Go ahead.
This baby Gabriel episode was really painful to get through because of Dick's constant arguing over every minute thing Jill said. It reminded me of my parents bickering and made me want to scream. Who cares why they chose Arkansas? Was her dad 36 or 107? Let's discuss this irrelevant detail for 5 minutes. Insert okay. Eye roll emoji. When you guys stick to the story and stop trying to one-up each other, it's much more enjoyable for the listener.
It is harsh. I think that's a little harsh. I mean, I think that you were a bit crotchety that day.
I will admit to being a little cantankerous that day.
And you were kind of, for some reason, you wouldn't let go why they went to Arkansas or how old her dad was. But
yeah, it probably seemed important to me at the time.
It must have.
It wasn't.
But it was only those 2 points, so.
Yeah.
I could have edited it out. I didn't find it that bad, but obviously it really bothered her.
It did.
Yeah.
But I think, Lauren, if you listen to our other ones, that I'm not such a crank.
No, you're rarely cranky. It's rare.
Okay.
Okay.
Then we have one from Shelley regarding Rachel O'Reilly.
Okay.
I thought you did an excellent job of getting across the humanity of Rachel and her family in the Rachel O'Reilly case. What a scumbag Joe was.
I agree. And it was really easy, though. I mean, thank you, but it was easy to get the humanity of that family because they were some sweet people.
They are. Well, yeah. You go back to these people that adopted all these kids.
Right,
raised
right.
them, had a beautiful home for them, beautiful, safe home, loving home.
Yes.
Yeah. I think their humanity comes through.
Her poor, heartbroken father just brought tears to my eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, I agree with you on that, Shelley. Now, Rhonda sent us an email regarding the Susan Smith episode. You did a great job on this one. I remember it well. It broke my heart. After this happened, my parents and my dad's brother and wife went to the Long Lake to see it. My uncle had investigated the genealogy of the family and reported to us that my dad's family, Savage, used to own the lake and a lot of the acreage there many years ago. Weird. My parents said it was a sad place to visit. Oh, I bet it was.
Oh, yeah.
I bet it's a very somber place to see. It's really, And well, then we talked about that family that went to see it, and some of them drowned.
Right.
So it just seems like
it's like a double tragedy.
It's like a sad place to visit on many levels.
So and then we have a recommendation from Kristen on Facebook. Have been listening to True Crime Brewery for a few weeks now, and noticed you haven't covered anything in Wyoming yet. Well, we haven't, have we?
No, there's probably a few states we haven't.
Well,
I haven't really been keeping track.
I haven't either, but I'm really sure we haven't done anything in Wyoming.
Okay.
Just thought I would throw out the Bob Duke story as an idea. They did a Dateline called Mystery at Lost Dog Road and also Cold Case Files, I believe. We don't have breweries here locally, but there should be some to choose from out of Jackson, Wyoming. Love your podcast. Well, you know, we're always looking for cases to do.
Yeah.
And this sounds like an interesting one, so.
So who was that?
Bob Duke.
No, who was the one that wrote it?
This is Krista.
Okay.
On Facebook.
Okay. So, Krista, I did read this email a little while back, and I think I wrote to you that we'd look into it. So then I was looking online because we watch a lot of Dateline. I've probably seen 90% at least of the Dateline episodes. And this one I saw was a Keith Morrison episode, which are definitely my favorites or some of my favorites. And I do remember, I think it was this guy that killed his wife and maybe his child. And his friend found out about it and turned him in or something. I vaguely remember it. So,
It's already on your radar.
Yeah, so I think we will watch it and do that one. We'll definitely get to it. Okay, is that it? We got more?
Well, I have another one.
Okay, go ahead.
This will be a quickie. This is David on Facebook. I'm hoping you guys do Jeffrey Dahmer soon. Well, that's another grisly one. And anyway.
No, it takes me a while to talk Dick into the grislier ones.
I have yet to hear a podcast do the story, and there is so much material on it. He's still casting a shadow here, and I love how you cover more of the victim side, which always gets overlooked because his victims were from a young immigrant to closeted gay men. The story has police negligence that lead to more deaths, as well as voodoo and cannibalism. It's a story that people know of, but not the whole thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely know of it, but I don't know any of that stuff. I know very little about it.
No.
So
I did know that there was cannibalism.
Well, yes. I think that's something we all know about it.
But not the possibility of police negligence that might have led to more deaths.
No.
So maybe we should look into that.
I think we could look into that. I think that's a possibility.
Okay.
Yep.
Adding more cases here.
Yes. Well, we do have a long list, but that's okay. That keeps us going, right? That keeps us in business.
That's right.
So I have a letter from Linda in North Carolina, and this is regarding Susan Smith. So she says, Jill and Dick, I just wanted to let you know that in 2015, Susan Smith said in a letter she wrote to The State, a newspaper, that she loved her boys. She said the deaths were unplanned, that she was distraught. She only lied about the boys being kidnapped, she said, because I don't know how to tell the people who loved Michael and Alex that they would never see them again.
So what does that mean?
I don't know.
Come on.
So she said she planned to kill herself. I had planned to kill myself first and leave a note behind telling what had happened, Smith said in her letter. I didn't believe I could face my family when the truth was revealed. Now, Mr. Cahill, I'm not the monster society thinks I am. I am far from it, she wrote to the reporter Harrison Cahill. In August 2014, the state submitted a letter to Smith asking if she would share her experiences of the trial and investigation for a 20th anniversary article regarding the untold stories of the Susan Smith case, which was published in the newspaper in that October. Now, Smith said she was unable to respond in time to tell her side because the letter was sent to the SCDC Correspondence Review Committee and was not approved until November 2014. I imagine that was done on purpose, Smith said. I wanted to let you know that I would have most likely responded to your letter because I have not been able to speak on my behalf. It has been hard to listen to lie after lie and not be able to defend myself. Keep up the great podcast, Linda in North Carolina.
Thank you, Linda.
So what do you think of what Susan wrote?
Well, I don't think there's much to defend herself against.
No, there's nothing here defending herself.
So?
Just saying that she planned on killing herself, that's no defense.
Oh, it isn't.
Not at all.
And I didn't plan on killing them. It just kind of happened.
Yeah. I have no sympathy for her, really.
No.
That was just an awful thing. And I think I have sympathy for a lot of people. I think I'm kind of a bleeding heart in some ways. But not for her, I don't.
No.
No. And this whole, well, I could have responded earlier, wah.
Yeah.
You know, she's where she belongs.
Yes, she is.
Yes. So then I also have one more, and this is from Lori. And she says, I had a classmate that was kidnapped and murdered in 1979. And she says that this person was a senior at Union Public Schools and was 1 year older than her. And she actually sent me a news article. Now she says, I remember going to Lisa's house and visiting her parents after her body was discovered. We were in a musical group together at Union. She was a very sweet, naive, innocent girl, as we all were at the time. Her older brother, Terry, graduated with my sister in 1977. I remember hearing that he had committed suicide, although I can't find any information to back that up. I know that he is indeed dead, as is Lisa's father, as her mother mentioned it in an interview. Terry was the last person to see Lisa alive and let her leave with her killer, so the responsibility for her death must have laid heavily on him. So she sent me these articles, and I'm going to look into doing this case. So, and this is Oklahoma.
Okay.
So I think this is a case I'm going to look into. Sometimes it's hard to do these lesser-known cases, but I think that from what she sent me, we could probably put an episode together.
There will probably be enough information.
I think so.
Okay.
Okay, so that's it for feedback this week.
Good feedback.
So that wraps up True Crime Brewery, and thanks everybody for listening.
Thanks. We'll see you at the quiet end.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.